You know, we get to know other people from stories, the stories they tell. It's almost like we getting to know someone. It's almost like you're conducting interviews of each other, getting their story, getting their background. And we find out, you know, where they grew up, attended school, what their parents were like, stories of their accomplishments and talents. As we get to know them, we observe acts of kindness and generosity that they performed, and negatives too. Gossip they've shared, lies they've told, commitments they've broken. It's really good to know them. You live with them over a period of time, the pain of guilt that they've borne, the stories, all the stories help us get to know them better. Relationships of fidelity are thick, not thin. They require a lot of narratives from various perspectives. People aren't one-sided, they're not two-sided, they're multifaceted. What about God? What stories do we know? Well, as Greg was reminding us, he's a God of love, compassion, and mercy. We've heard story after story of his kindness and gracious provision, his eagerness to forgive. But there are other stories too. Walter Brueggemann famously said, "We worship a God that's been implicated in violence." Yes, we know those stories. Overthrow of governments and nations, exile, earthquakes, pestilence, famine, part of our family story as children of God, although a part we'd probably rather not think about. We don't like to talk about it. What do we do with such a hormonal God? So emotional, so violent, so deeply hurt, a God like we see him in Hosea. I want to look at Hosea this morning. Hosea is pain set to poetry, beautiful poetry, painful. Hosea gathers metaphors and he tells the story of the train wreck that's about to happen in Israel. Hosea, when he looked at Israel, saw below the surface. He saw below the apparent prosperity and power of the upper class. He saw how sick, how wicked, how hypocritical Israel was. Hosea knew more, and he was haunted by what he knew. Hosea's setting is similar to the setting of Amos that we talked about last week, not far from the time of Elijah and Elisha. It's the 8th century BC in the northern kingdom of Israel, where God sent all these incredible prophets, even though they were so faithless. It was a time of great national prosperity and power, at least among the elites. It was a time of faithlessness to God, Baal worship, with all the inhumane acts that accompany Baal worship, acts of injustice, oppression, sexual promiscuity, abuse, cruelty to orphans, widows, and aliens, and the poor. That's what worshiping Baal engendered. How can God get through to these people, these well-off, pampered, evil people? How can he get them to see the truth about themselves and the inevitable destruction their path was leading them toward? He's creative and resourceful. He sends Elijah to confront Baal's prophets on Mount Carmel and demonstrate that Yahweh alone is God. He sends Elisha to demonstrate his wisdom and faithfulness. He sends Amos to force them to face the reality of their hypocrisy in beautiful, powerful, poetic language. But that doesn't tell them every story they need to hear to get to know their God. That doesn't help them truly see the terrible, heartbreaking impact of the choices that they're making on God, the pain they're causing him. So he sends Hosea to demonstrate that God is not objectively disengaged. He isn't distant. And their relationship with God is not a legal matter. It's not just Deuteronomic rewards and curses. Do well and I'll reward you. Be unfaithful to me and I'll curse you. Our relationship with God is not business. It's personal. Hosea proves that dealing with God can't be boiled down to reward versus punishment. It isn't thin. It's thick. Hosea demonstrates how God suffers over his relationship with Israel. Hosea 1, verse 2 and 3. When the Lord began to speak through Hosea, the Lord said to him, "Go marry a promiscuous woman and have children with her. For like an adulterous wife, this land is guilty of unfaithfulness to the Lord." So he married Gomer, daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. The story of Hosea begins with a wedding. What God calls Hosea to do is pretty scandalous. God says to Hosea, "You're my prophet. I want to use you to be a communicator of who I am. Not just what you say, what you do, the way you live, your experiences. I want to use you to tell people what I'm like." To which Hosea says, "Amen, done. I'm your guy. I believe in you." Because Hosea is a man who loves God, a man who fears God, who wants to do what God says. So God says, "In order for you to do that, I want you to get married." To which Hosea says, "Right on. I'm on to that. You know my needs. This is great, because being a prophet can be a lonely job. God, I would love to have a godly woman to walk with me and encourage me and pray for me and be with me. Lord, where am I going to get this woman to be my wife?" And the Lord said to him, "Go take to yourself an adulterous wife and children of unfaithfulness, because the land is guilty of the vilest adultery in departing from the Lord." What God is saying to Hosea is, "Hosea, I want your life to be an object lesson. I want your marriage to be a living parable of my love for Israel and Israel's unfaithfulness. I want your marriage to be a symbol of my relationship to my people. So Hosea, I want you to marry an adulterous woman, a promiscuous woman, a woman of unfaithfulness, a woman of harlotry. Hosea, you and I are going to be tied together in this. You and I are going to give our hearts and our lives to someone who will utterly reject us, betray us, will cheat on us, and who will break our hearts. Your relationship with your wife will mirror my relationship with my people, because I am a husband whose wife is unfaithful to him." This is staggering. It's staggering because there are hundreds of metaphors in the Bible for God. God is like a rock. God is like a shield. God is like a consuming fire. God is a shepherd. God is a judge. God is a king. But it's actually idolatry to define God as one-dimensional. God is a nursemaid. God is a warrior. That's just one side of the fence. God is indescribable, undefinable. God is, "I am what I am. I am who I am." Here in Hosea, God says, if you want to understand me, if you want to understand my heart, you have to see me as a husband whose wife has left him for another lover. All the pain, all the hurt of that, all the anguish of that is what I experience when my people turn away from me and sin against me and destroy themselves. Now, we generally view sin, most of the time we view sin from our vantage point. What we do, what we pay, what we pursue. God in Hosea turns the telescope around and gives us some insight into what sin looks like from his perspective, from his heart, our sin, what that looks like from him looking at it. So we're told in verse 3 that God takes Hosea to a woman named Gomer of Diblaim. We don't know much about this woman other than Gomer is like a city without walls. She must have been attractive to men, but she's defenseless against her own passions and impulses. As a result, she's been continuously unfaithful to whoever she is with, whether she's married to them or not. She's been around and around and around. She's left an entire history, a trail of broken hearts behind her. She's broken lives on that trail of grief and betrayal. God takes Hosea to her when she's in this condition, when she's in this state, and he says, "This is the woman for you to marry." And so there's a public wedding. There are whispers, there's gossip floating around the community. What in the world is a man like Hosea, the prophet of God, doing with Gomer of Diblaim? I mean, doesn't he know who she is? Doesn't he know what she's like? Doesn't he know what she's capable of? Will she cheat on him? Will she leave him? And sure enough, it doesn't take long. Gomer immediately begins to be unfaithful to Hosea. She bears 3 children, and at least the last one, isn't his child. He names him Loemi, which means not mine. Which, by the way, reminds me, as I was reading this, don't give your daughter the name Gomer. It's a good thing it's not an attractive name. I've never met a woman named Gomer. I'm glad of that. And don't give your child a name like Loemi, not mine. That is not a good thing. So the names in Hosea, you know, you don't want to follow. Stick with nice biblical names like Joseph and Mark and Rachel and Mary and all those other good names. Hosea knows who he is marrying. He knows what she's like. He knows the type of woman Gomer is. He knows what might happen if he obeys God and enters into a relationship with her. He knows that when he marries her, his own credibility, his reputation, his heart, and his life will take a hit. He also knows that to love means to take on the burden of being hurt. To love means to take a risk of vulnerability, to make yourself vulnerable. They say love hurts, love does hurt. To love means to put yourself in a position where another person can hurt you deeply, can betray you, and put you through more pain than you can imagine. That's why C.S. Lewis says, love anything and your heart will be wrung and possibly broken. If you don't want that to happen, if you don't want your heart to be broken, if you want to keep it intact, lock it up. Don't give your heart to anything or anyone. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your own selfishness. In that casket, it will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. If you love something or someone, you're opening yourself up to pain because love means vulnerability. I said last week that growth is painful. There's no growth without pain. But without love, there's no motivation to really grow. Love will change you, and all life-changing love is, in some ways, a form of substitutionary sacrifice. Take parenting, for example. Our children are adorable. We love them, but they're not self-sufficient human beings. They're filled with neediness and dependency. They need to be fed. Their diapers need to be changed. You have to be cleaned up. They have early bedtimes that have to be honored. So to be a loving, nurturing parent means you have to kiss your freedom goodbye. You're going to have to read them books, and the books you have to read them are boring. You're going to have to spend time with them and play endless games of peekaboo with them, and you're going to have to pray with them. You're going to have to teach them things they don't want to learn, like don't bite your sister, don't bite your brother, don't bite your friend. And there will be pain. There will be times when they're sick or hurt or sad or experience failure, and you will suffer. As they get older, this person you poured your life into will begin pulling away from you and pushing you away from them. That begins at age 2, and it accelerates from there. There'll be battles. There'll be self-recrimination. There'll be heartbreak. Love is a many-splendored thing, but also love hurts. When you love, you're taking on the burden of suffering on that person's behalf. And that's exactly what Hosea does when he marries Gomer. That's what Paul is talking about when he's speaking about his ministry to that rebellious, impetuous Corinthian church. He said in 2 Corinthians 4, verse 12, so then death is at work in us, but life is at work in you. Death is at work in us, but life is at work in you. What Paul's saying is that if you want to be a loving person, if you want to minister to people, if you want to help people become redeemed and changed, transformed, if you want to heal brokenness, you will have to suffer. I had some positive experiences while doing some training and counseling and group therapy while I was in college studying to be a minister. I took some courses at the Center of Marriage and Family Therapy, Carl Burkeen. After that, I helped with some things, and he suggested that I consider changing from biblical studies to a counseling degree program. But I found it too emotionally draining, too painful to get that deep with people in everything they're going through. I couldn't sleep that whole semester. I decided I wasn't tough enough for that. I figured at age 20 that preaching might be hard enough, but surely it's not that hard. Death has to be working in you for life to be at work in others. And get this, Paul follows the statement that death is at work in him with a promise in verse 16. He says, "Therefore we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all." What Paul is saying is that love is worth it. When you love people in this sacrificial way, if you love people with a suffering love, death may be at work in you, but life is at work in them. It's this suffering love that's making you great. There's something redemptive about it. It's making you wise. This suffering love is making you deep. It's making you loving. It's making you compassionate. It's making you like Jesus. It's making you like Jesus. And that's the part it's going to last. That's the real you, not the foolishness and the selfishness and the pettiness. That stuff's being chipped away by God through suffering love. So instead of being surprised by the burden of love, when we enter into difficult relationships, understand that the greater the life you want to have, the more suffering you're going to endure. It comes with the territory. That's the only way you're going to change others. That's the only way you're going to help others grow. And that's the only way you're going to change yourself. Now, the scene shifts in Hosea chapter 2. There we read of Israel's unfaithfulness to God and how she runs to another husband. His name is Baal. But Israel and Gomer are the same. To speak of Israel's unfaithfulness is to speak of Gomer's unfaithfulness. So Hosea 2 verse 5, "I will go after my lovers who give me my bread and my water, my wool and flax, my oil and my drink." But she, in this case Israel, did not know, God says, that it was I who gave her the grain, the wine and the oil, her silver and gold, which they used to worship Baal. Hosea chapter 3 makes it clear that Gomer has left him and is committing adultery with another man. The commentator Derek Kidner says, "Remember, this marriage is a microcosm of God and his people. Once more, the reader is confronted by a mirror rather than a window, because Israel's sin is humanity's sin." What Kidner is saying is when you read a story like this, when you read Hosea, and you're like, oh my goodness, when you read a story like this, it's like walking into a room and looking at a painting on the opposite wall and saying to yourself, oh my goodness, that's an ugly painting. That's an ugly picture. That's an ugly person. And then you realize it's not a painting. It's a mirror. In other words, God is saying, this is you. This is you, my people. This is us. This is me. Because every time we forget God, every time we sin against God, every time we look to other things as our ultimate joy and satisfaction besides God, God is saying, this is you. This is you, my people. This is us. This is me. God is saying, that's us. That's the nature of your unfaithfulness to my love for you. One of the central truths of the book of Hosea is that whenever we turn our backs on God and devote ourselves to the things of this world, we're all spiritual adulterers. We're like Gomer. That's the truth about us. There's another truth, and that's about God. It's this: God knows that his wife is a harlot, but God still loves her. He still wants her. He still pursues her. Some of you may think that you're too dirty or broken or sinful for God's love. The message of Hosea is that God knows exactly who you are. He knows you through and through. He knows you to the depth of your being, and he still wants you. He still loves you. But there are no shortcuts in healing these types of relationships, not even for God. Let's remember that the God we're talking about here is the God who spoke creation into being. He said, "Let there be light," and by the word of his mouth there was light. Yet even God does not change the hearts of people with a wave of his hand, by the command of his voice. He does it by showing them a constant, relentless, restless, unfailing, long-suffering love. He draws them to him. I tell you this because many of us here have loved ones who our hearts are broken for this morning. We think about them, and when we pray for them, we want instant redemption and instant healing and instant restoration, but there are no shortcuts, not even for God. God is long-suffering. God is patient. God never gives up. He never gives up. His love never sleeps. Your love will go to bed at night. His love never sleeps. It never rests. His love will pursue to the ends of the wilderness. So don't stop praying and don't stop hoping. The question is not whether God is patient. The question is, will I be patient? Will you be patient? Will you wait? Because sometimes waiting is the hardest thing to do for a loved one. Will you wait? Will you trust? And will you believe that God is good? God is like a parent whose love is unfailing when the child, even when the child is rebellious. Hosea 11, 1 through 4, I love it. When Israel was a child, I loved him. And out of Egypt, I called my son. But the more they were called, the more they went away from me. They sacrificed to the Baals. They burned incense to images. It was I who taught Ephraim to walk, taking them by the arms. But they did not realize it was I who healed them. I led them with cords of human kindness, with ties of love. To them, I was like one who lifts a little child to the cheek. And I bent down to feed them. God's love is like a parent who never gives up hope. But what about Hosea? His wife has been unfaithful to him. So surely God has freed Hosea from his obligation to Gomer, right? He's free to divorce her, and no one would blame him, right? But Hosea's marriage to Gomer is tied up with God's marriage to Israel. Hosea is beside himself. He truly loves Gomer, but she's turned his world upside down. The pain of her abandonment is more than words can describe. It's more than he can bear. She's pushed all his buttons. She's driven him mad with frustration. No matter what he does, no matter what he says, she's continually unfaithful to him. And then God comes to Hosea and says, "Go. Show your love to your wife again." A word again, I mean, that's a beautiful word. That's a picture of God's love for you again and again and again. He says in Hosea 3, "Go show your love to your wife again, though she is loved by another and is an adulteress." And then it says, "So I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and about a homer and a lethic of barley." Now, homer and a lethic of barley is about 9 bushels, and 9 bushels is about 15 shekels. About 9 bushels, about 15 shekels each. So basically what this is telling us is that Gomer was bought for 30 shekels, which was the going rate for a slave in those days. What this must mean is that she had sunk down to a place so low, she had sunk down to a place so low that she was up for sale. She has a price. The guy who has her is going to charge a price for her. She's at the lowest point of her life. She's at the very depth of her degradation. She's at a point where she feels the most worthless, the most rejected, the most useless. So she sits there or stands there with her head down and her eyes closed as the people begin to bid on her. "I'll give 9 shekels, 10 shekels, 13 shekels. All of a sudden she pauses. She looks up because one of the voices is familiar. She realizes one of the voices in the crowd is her husband's voice. Somebody says, 14 shekels. Hosea says, 15 shekels. Somebody says, 15 shekels and 6 bushels of barley. Hosea says, 15 shekels and 9 bushels of barley. The gavel comes down and he gets her. He's bought her. She walks up to Gomer. and he covers her nakedness. He takes her by the hand and he leads her away. And now imagine you're Gomer. Imagine what you're thinking. Imagine what you're thinking. She's saying, how in the world could he love me after all that I've done? There's no way. There's no way. He couldn't possibly love me. He doesn't love me. He's bought me as a slave to take revenge on me. He's purchased me to punish me. Yet Hosea takes her to a place of privacy and he says to her, Gomer, I just want to let you know, I don't want you as a slave. I don't want you just to be in the house. If you come back with me, I want you to be my wife. I will be your husband, and you'll be my wife. So Hosea 3, verse 3, then I told her, you're to live with me many days. You must not be a prostitute or be intimate with any man, and I will behave the same way toward you. That's a picture of God's love for you. He wants intimacy with you. He wants closeness. He wants to be the lover of your soul. He wants to be in a faithful relationship with you. See, God and Christ doesn't want to just be chosen. He wants to be cherished. And this is a love that doesn't care what other people think. This is love that's completely undignified. People are saying, oh, there's Gomer. Right up there, Hosea is saying, yeah, that's right. That's my wife. I'm going to get her back no matter what it costs me. These people, God's extreme love for them is like a parent of a sullen, rebellious teen who's driven to scream. All the right buttons are pushed. Love makes him crazy. He's like a father talking to himself, at odds with himself, contending with his own heart. What should he do about this rebellious son that he loves so much? God is struggling with this. Hosea 11, verse 8 and 9. How can I give you up, Ephraim? How can I hand you over, Israel? How can I treat you like Admah? How can I make you like Zeboim? My heart is changed within me. All my compassion is aroused. I will not carry out my fierce anger, nor will I devastate Ephraim again. For I am God and not a man, the Holy One among you. I will not come against their cities. God again delays his punishment of Israel. Gives her again and again more time to come around. And Hosea redeems Gomer. So what does Gomer do? After everything she's done to him, after every chance he's given her, does it work? Does she change? Was she transformed eventually by his unfailing love? We don't know. We don't know because it doesn't say. That's where the story of Gomer and Hosea ends. He buys her back. And maybe part of the reason the story of Gomer and Hosea ends like that is because it's a living parable of God's relationship with his people. Where the story of Hosea and Gomer ends, your story picks up. Your relationship with God picks up right there. And the question is, how will you respond to God's love? How will you respond after all you've done to him, buying you back, not to be his slave, to be his lover? The pertinent question this morning is not, how does Gomer respond? The real question is, how will I respond to God's loving faithfulness to me? Because you have been shown a love that's greater than Hosea's love for Gomer. And as great as Hosea's love for Gomer was, you've been shown a greater love because Jesus Christ, the true bridegroom, is the greater Hosea who paid the ultimate price for you. Far more than 30 shekels of silver, he gave himself. 1 Peter 1:18 says, you have been redeemed. You've been purchased. You've been bought not with perishable things like gold or silver, but by the precious blood of Christ. And the question is, how will you respond to that? Are we melted by that love? Will we be changed? Will we be transformed by that love? Will you turn toward God because of that love? God loves you with a self-sacrificing love. He's vulnerable to your decision. His heart is an open door to you. The question is, are we going to break his heart all over again? Are we going to abandon him again and run after other lovers? Are we going to be faithful to that relationship and live in the joy of that relationship in that happy, healthy home, the only place where we will ever be truly home?